The Honorable Chief Justice and Justices of the Supreme Court of Ohio. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Be seated, please. First case on our calendar is 99-991, Klosterman Baking Company versus the Administrative Bureau of Employment Services. Mr. Siegel.
Side contends that the contract had expired, that you had not made an offer at that period of time to continue working under the same terms and conditions, and they implemented unilaterally their own program. How do you answer that?
The answer, Your Honor, is one, that the offer at that time to continue negotiating impliedly included an offer to continue working under the terms and existing conditions. The employees did indeed continue to work, thus confirming the fact that it was their desire at that time to continue to work, that an offer to just utter the words under the terms and conditions of the existing contract would have been futile at that time, because the employer flatly stated that the negotiations were not warranted and the employer cut off the negotiations.
Does Bays versus Shenango require anything more than an implied offer to continue under the same terms and conditions?
It does not, under the circumstances of this case and perhaps many other cases. Moreover, when the negotiations continued in June of 94, the union very clearly said that it wanted to continue working under the terms and conditions of the pre-existing contract, which was the status quo. So the Bays test was satisfied, in my estimation, both in 1993 in September and in 1994 in June. It was the employer that was determined not to negotiate. The Bays test then, Your Honor, I believe, was quite clearly satisfied.
There seems to be some convoluted procedural problem here with the Bureau saying no, that you're not entitled, then when the court says you are, goes back and the Bureau then gives it to you, and then what happened next?
Okay, here's what the problem there was. And I call the First Court of Appeals decision Klosterman. Appeals gave what was called the Board of Review at that time absolutely clear instructions as to how to apply the status quo test. It said the status quo is the pre-existing contract, that the employer cannot unilaterally create a new status quo, apply it as of June 16, 1994, which was when the negotiations continued and the union continued to want to continue to work under the existing status quo. So the board followed those instructions. I mean, they understood them clearly and expressly followed them and decided that the claimants were unemployed due to a lockout that was in June of 97. The administrator then paid the benefits, but then the administrator and Klosterman appealed again, and with the administrator saying they don't like the decision of Klosterman 1 in the Court of Appeals, and Klosterman saying we asked for another hearing before the board, and the board denied us another hearing. It gets to the Court of Appeals the second time, and they say, yep, that's right, the board should have given Klosterman a hearing. You lose. To the claimants, they could have easily turned around and said, Klosterman loses. They just jumped the huge gap of ordering a hearing if that's what they thought should have been done.
That's your alternative argument, is that at least there should have been a hearing ordered rather than the Court of Appeals entering judgment.
Sure. The Court of Appeals definitely was wrong in entering judgment. I don't agree with the Court of Appeals that there should have been more hearing. I think there was plenty of hearing and enough to satisfy everybody already. But Klosterman 1 was the law of the case, and what the Court of Appeals and Klosterman 2 really did, oh, by the way, Klosterman 1 was appealed to this court, and this court declined jurisdiction. So it was fine. It was the law of the case. Court of Appeals and Klosterman 2 really reversed Klosterman 1. It didn't like the decision, and it reversed it and created a chaotic situation by doing that. So the next question is, why am I here today? Because if Klosterman 2 is allowed to stand, the administrator is going to come back on the employees and try to get back the benefits that were paid back in 97, and that's going to be even more chaotic.
Can the administrator appeal without the board's approval?
Yes. The administrator
under
is
what?
The party they can appeal. The board is more like a court, like a tribunal. They don't appeal on their own. They can join or be made a party. They can come in, but it's up to the administrator to appeal.
I know the administrator ultimately is a state employee. Does the administrator work for the board?
No. The administrator works for the state. The board works for the state. The board is an administrative tribunal that makes adjudications.
Other than the governor, who supervises directly the administrator?
Nobody.
The board?
No. The board, the administrator is bound by the decisions of the board.
Yes.
But can appeal. So the board really doesn't supervise the administrator. The administrator indeed is bound by the decision.
Would you concede what you just said is maybe incongruous? You said that the administrator is bound by the decision of the board, but the administrator can appeal it.
Right. Here's the way
they're not bound.
The administrator looks at it. We have to pay these benefits because the board ruled in favor of the claimants, but we don't like what the Court of Appeals said and we're going to appeal. And that creates a chaotic situation, no question. And it's quite damaging, of course, to the claimants, and isn't good for the employer either. Now, again, I don't know if the alternative argument is the most important to the administration of justice. I have this feeling that maybe it is, that this court respectfully needs to tell the courts of appeals that when you make a decision and that decision has been appealed to this court and has become final, it is the law of the case and it must be followed.
Why would we need to state that such a fundamental principle?
Because they ignored it.
But I mean, at worst, isn't this just a case of error? In your view, they erred. But what principle, what new or changing principle of law can be presented by this case?
Well, as far as a new or changing...
You're asking that we state the law of the case doctrine.
No, I'm not suggesting that there's a new law of the case.
Right.
I'm suggesting that it's so flagrant in this case, it absolutely demands correction.
But correct, well, this isn't a court that corrects.
Well, but we are going to lose significantly in the administration of justice definitely suffers.
The
courts of appeals can simply change decisions the second time around where it's been appealed once to the Supreme Court. Okay, I said I had questions whether that was the most important principle. The other important principle, obviously, is the application of the Bayes test on the substantive issue.
But if there even is an error in the application of the test, that wouldn't seem to meet the constitutional standard for the case being heard at this court.
The question is the proper application of the test, which is confused, I must say, and here we get into another area, by the continuing life of Zanesville Rapid Transit versus Bayless, which is an old, I think, in the 1950s case on lockout, which is continuing to confuse things in the lower courts as well as the board as to how do we go about determining whether or not a lockout exists. And I think that issue also needs to be addressed, in my opinion. Zanesville should be put to rest.
That's really the threshold question, isn't it? Because if we decide how we decide Bayes applies or does not apply determines what we do with the law of the case.
It does indeed. Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stevens. Mr. Berg.
Say, yes, there should have been further hearing, by the Board of Review to find their fact. And the Board of Review, when presented with the remand from Klosterman 1, determined that the facts were sufficient that they had before them, and they made their decision based on that. So then when this case comes up to the Court of Appeals in Klosterman 2, the Court of Klosterman 2 can't supply factual deficiencies that they might find in the record, and therefore they're left to make a decision with the record before it that the Board of Review thought was sufficient. And the Court of Appeals said that record is not sufficient on its basis to support the claimant's right to unemployment. Therefore, they're denied.
Did the lower court refuse to give a hearing? How did that go about that no hearing was held in the
Your Honor, on the remand to the Board of Review, the Board of Review simply then issued a decision in writing. Yes, after they issued a decision in writing, Klosterman wrote to the Board of Review and formally requested that the hearing be held. The Board of Review then wrote back in a letter and said, we review the entire record. We don't believe further hearing is necessary.
Did the union also join in the request?
I don't believe, no, they did not. In fact, they responded saying that no further hearing was necessary, and that the Board of Review's decision should stand.
So the union was standing on the evidence that had already been suggested that she did not
That's correct, sir.
If my concern is that the Board refuses the hearing, and then the Court of Appeals basically tells the union, you lose because you didn't present enough evidence, what form could they have presented more evidence unless they gave you something they don't want to
That's a good point, Your Honor. I don't know whether they, I wouldn't say they formally waived it, but they certainly had the opportunity, if they thought the record was sufficient, to have joined in when we requested the new hearing be held and asked for that, and they didn't do that. Apparently, they thought that the facts were sufficient that were developed, and the Board of Appeals differed from that.
Do we reach a fair solution that we simply remanded to have the hearing that possibly can be made?
I think this court could do a number of things. I think this court could affirm the Court of Appeals decision in Klosterman 2. I think this court could remand for a new hearing. I think this court could simply reverse the decision based on Klosterman 1. So I think the court could do any of those. And frankly, my position on behalf of Klosterman at this point is, given what I said earlier, that we are not specifically requesting that this court, if it were to find against Klosterman, send this back for a rehearing and begin the process all over again. Simply by virtue of the fact that this has gone on for 6 years, and my client does have continuing good relationships with the union, and we believe that this court has the jurisdiction to make a fair and just result here, and that's what we're asking for.
I think what you're saying is you'd like us to clarify what the law is and you'll live with it. You have to live with it, but you're comfortable living with it.
I'm comfortable with this court deciding yes. I think that it's one final point I'd like to make.
May I ask, counsel, what law do you think this case presents for us to clarify?
Well, I don't think that this court, as we argued it in the jurisdictional memo, I don't believe there is a decision for this court, and I don't think this is, in that sense, properly before this court, but that's your decision, not mine. So I don't believe there is a new law for this court. Finally, I wanted to note was just, I think it's important to remember that when this went back to the Board of Review, Klosterman 1, the panel there, really made a very significant departure from existing law at that point on two particular points. They threw out the economic unreasonable exception that was developed in the Uribe case, and they also held essentially the Zanesville case is no longer good law outside the narrow case of a public utility. So I think that was a significant departure, and that was more reason perhaps for the Board of Review to look at it in a more full sense. I do want to give the rest of my time to Mr. Lefton. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Mr. Lefton.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm court's terms, we would argue that we need to still good law, and that proposal that the lockout is the cessation of the furnishing of work to the employee or the withholding of work by the employer in order to get more favorable terms from the union.
Well, to adopt your position or the Attorney General's position, then we have to overrule Bays versus Shenango.
We are not asking this court to overrule Bays versus Shenango.
Yeah, but Bays holds differently than what you say your position is.
No, that's not our contention that Bays holds differently. Bays provides a more general definition of what a lockout is, and then Bays applies a particular test to determine whether a lockout exists in a circumstance where the parties are in negotiations for a new collective bargaining agreement.
Well, I don't think there's any disagreement what a lockout is. It's not even in this case. You know, we have a lot of National Labor Relations Board cases. We have CERB cases. Everybody knows what a lockout is. We want to came to work one day and you lock the doors. So what's going to be established there? This case is about a continuation of a contract.
Is that correct? We don't disagree with that.
So why are you here?
Well, we're here because of the award of the unemployment benefits to the claimants in this case, and that's what's at stake. And we are asking this court to affirm the second fostering decision by the Court of Appeals in Hamilton County. Basically, speaking of the unemployment compensation, the statute, Revised Code Section 4141.29, provides that no unemployment benefits will be paid if there's a labor dispute that is not a lockout. And that's exactly what happened here. That was the decision of the administrator from the outset, and then that was the decision ultimately of the Court of Appeals. Now, applying the status quo test to this particular case, one must look and determine which party, the employer or the union, sought to maintain the status quo, which side first refused to continue operations after the contract expired, but while negotiations continued. And it's our position that neither side offered to continue the status quo. And contrary to what Mr. Siegel said, there was not an implied offer by the union in September of 93 to continue the status quo. Indeed, in September of 93, the union had taken the vote to strike in this case, and at that point, Fostering concluded that there was an impasse, and no meaningful negotiations were continuing. And that's when Fostering implemented the final terms of their offer.
You always take a strike vote, don't you? I mean, have you ever seen a contract that came up to near the end where a strike vote wasn't taken even before the end of the contract date? They always do that.
Well, they
how could you assume anything from that?
Well, they took a strike vote, and sometimes parties will vote to strike, and sometimes they will vote not to strike. In this case, they voted to go on strike. And Fosterman saw that as an end to the negotiations, in a sense.
They voted to go on strike or to give their union officials the authority to call a strike. Those are different concepts in the law.
Well,
but I understand what you're saying.
Okay.
Well, I'm not sure, though, why we're really still talking about the factual decision about whether or not the status quo, wasn't that decided in Klosterman 1 and is the law of the case? Klosterman 1 decided that there was no new status quo created.
And we don't disagree with that. There was no new status quo created. But it's our contention that negotiations had ended when Klosterman implemented the final terms of their offer. And at that time, since negotiations had ended, status quo test was not even applied. Because one of the prerequisites of the status quo test is that negotiations be ongoing, and negotiations had definitely ended. So
that's a factual decision made by, I mean, appellate courts don't usually affect those factual decisions made by finders of fact.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that was a factual determination made at the outset by my client, the administrator.
counsel, what's wrong there is that who's driving this appeal at this point? Fosterman 2 got going. At whose urging?
Well, it's the union that has appealed to this court.
No, no, no. How did Fosterman 1 get a final answer at the Court of Appeals? Should have been up, but it wasn't. Now, who was pushing to keep this alive?
Well, this case has a convoluted procedural history. In Fosterman 1, the Court of Appeals remanded this case to the Board of Review.
Right.
The Board of Review then issued another decision contrary to its prior decision, which then awarded benefits to the claimants. So,
following the direction of the Court of Appeals.
Following the direction of the Court of Appeals.
So now, why is it over?
Well, then Fosterman, as well as Wright, appealed that decision to the Court of Common Pleas. The Court of Common Pleas affirmed that decision, which was then appealed to the Court of Appeals a second time.
And the administrator was not involved in any of that.
No, the administrator was a party once the matter was back before the Court of Common Pleas. And we, at that point, joined with Fosterman.
My impression is they've lost some zeal for this, but apparently the administrator hasn't.
Well, in a sense, we're waiting for some guidance from this court as well, as all parties are in this case.
What guidance do you want that doesn't come from Bays versus Shenango?
Well, I think what we're looking for is more of a determination on this particular case, whether the Fosterman 2 decision can stand, and it's our position that decision should stand, that there is no proposition of law for this court really to determine, and that there was no error by the court.
So it would give you the direction you want if we said affirm, or conversely said reversed judgment for the employees, pay the benefits. That gives you what you want?
Well, certainly we're advocating a particular position in this case.
Oh.
But in another sense, the administrator is merely an actor administering the unemployment compensation fund. But we would have to the court then affirm the decision of the Court of Appeals in this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Lutton.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Siegel, you've stayed a little over 4 minutes.
First, I will join the court in saying that there is indeed a good relationship. There is a contract. These benefits have been paid. This decision needs to be reversed because it was indeed final. Second, the employer never offered any economic evidence in the first hearing. So that in case we are thinking maybe that is some kind of issue. They never took the opportunity to bring in any evidence whatsoever. And third, the administrator is a little bit, how shall I say it, they're trying to talk out both sides of their mouth. On the one hand, he says, well, we administer this, and that's supposed to be fair. But they are indeed pushing an agenda. That's the answer to that question. They would like to see Fosterman 1 wiped out. And I'm sure they'd like to return to Zanesville Rapid Transit for some baby if they could ever get there.
How many employees were there? 49?
I believe there are 45 claimants. I think there are about 65 in the bargaining unit, 100 employees altogether.
But 45 received benefits.
Yes.
So let's follow that through logistically. If the Court of Appeals opinion in this case stands, then each of those 45 is required to pay back the administrator the unemployment benefits they got?
The administrator can do one of two things. Come after them directly, sue them, in other words, for the benefits.
Yeah, individually.
Demand that they pay them individually.
Maybe we'll get a class action suit out of the Attorney General.
It could keep going that way. Or take it out of future unemployment benefits. In either case, a bigger disaster than not paying the benefits was in the very first instance. Not only employees, but as both sides, the employer at least and the union are saying, at least impliedly, in the collective bargaining relationship and labor relationship.
But your second alternative assumes that there's going to be another layoff for lack of work to draw unemployment benefits. We don't know that, do
well, we?
In fact, we would hope that there
hope
is not.
But if there is, if this administrator has this administrator's way, they're going to try to take the money back out of benefits. It cost them 2 cents, and it just completely, what happened is a grave injustice and cries out for correction.
Well, you'd hope there isn't any more layoffs. In fact, Klosterman makes good bread, don't they?
Klosterman makes good bread.
It's good stuff.
And makes good bread, and it's good union bread.
Did you put that in the syllabus? Syllabus law from that?
Yes, that's Klosterman good makes good union bread, and everybody should go out and buy it. Thank you.
In case you submitted, you'd be advised of our opinion.